Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Last month, Public Radio Tulsa hosted a give-and-take event about the recent release of Tulsa's Mental Health Improvement Plan. It's a 10-year roadmap which identified major gaps in care for persons with serious mental illness and offers recommendations about how we can improve things. One of that evening's panelists was Dr. Nicole Washington, who has spent her career as both an academic and community-based psychiatrist caring for people with serious mental illness like schizophrenia and severe bipolar disorder. Now Dr. Washington has branched out. In a career pivot, she has developed a private practice in which she works with high-level professionals having emotional issues that can impact mood and performance. But those individuals are often too afraid of stigma or recognition to cross the barrier to getting help. Her new private practice, Elosin Psychiatric Services, caters to these professionals using telephonic or in-person visits. She's just written her first book, a companion guide called From Introspection to Action, The High-Level Professional's 28-Day Journey to Improving Mental Health. Dr. Nicole Washington of Family and Children's Services of Tulsa is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Nicole Washington, welcome to Medical Monday. So from introspection to action, what inspired you to write the book?
I have, over the years, known a lot of colleagues who have struggled with mental health issues and were either embarrassed to go see a psychiatrist or afraid of running into patients in town, and not just physicians, but other, I guess, high-profile careers, attorneys. If you want to go out and get help, but you're concerned that you're going to run into a client or a patient, that can be a barrier to treatment because of stigma. I have at times myself had periods where I thought, man, I really could benefit from a short-term stint of talking to someone to work through some things, but just being worried about who could I go see, who are they, am I going to see anybody, what's going to happen. So I just thought it was probably time to do something to target those folks who are struggling, but functioning at a high enough level that their impairment may or may not be appreciated.
So many psychiatric training programs have, I think, supervision or therapy as part of the training. So, at least as a psychiatrist, you could at least have the cover if you needed it of, I have to do this for my training. Was that part of your training or was it not?
We had psychotherapy training where we learned about psychotherapy. We did not have the requirement to participate actively in our own individual psychotherapy.
I mean, it sounds like that would be really beneficial.
I think it could be.
Yeah.
And they used to a long time ago. I think that was a requirement several years ago, and I think over the years that has just stopped.
Well, and so for these professionals you refer to, doctors, lawyers, professionals, it certainly is a reality. But, I mean, don't we think, or I guess don't we hope that stigma is going away to where any of us might see a mental health professional or seek some kind of counseling or therapy or psychotherapy, but it's just the fact of the matter is, you have identified a client base that is now, because of your practice, are seeking you out essentially because of the fear that they have or the stigma.
Yes. So one of the things that we know, there's been a lot of research here recently about physician suicides, and we think we're losing roughly a physician a day in this country to suicide. So around 300, 400 in a year's time that we're losing to suicide, and those are just the ones that we're losing. That doesn't account for the ones who are miserable and stressed and not doing something about it. And then we have licensing boards that ask us questions like, have you been involved in any kind of mental health treatment? And so people are afraid to say yes or afraid to go because what if my board finds out? What if, you know, I'm not able to get licensed? What if I get ready to go get credentials somewhere and they ask me if I've ever been treated for a mental health disorder? And those are things that are commonly asked.
That's right. And it really can red flag your application or your license renewal. And then you wind up having to do extra pages of submission every time. I hadn't thought about that, but that's absolutely true.
Yes. And then you take into account that stigma is still there. We hope it's going away. But everyone isn't going to be as open to seeing their doctor or their kid's doctor at the psychiatrist that they're going to.
Right. So how long have you had this practice? How new is it?
Very new. It's an infant. Very, very new.
Are you finding that it's, sort of taking off in terms of, and is it word of mouth? One client sort of refers another or something like that?
Yeah, it's a lot of word of mouth. And I still run into people who will talk to me for an initial, let's just talk about the practice and how it's different than other practices and are you a good fit? And I still have some people who are, I think, hesitant just to even go there.
Now, do you, because of the privacy concerns, you wind up, I think you mentioned to me that you do at least some of this or maybe all of it in virtual, so it's done over a computer or something like that?
Most of my visits can be done tele, and that is how things are designed, is for it to be a telepractice. However, I do also have office space available that I can use, that if a person just feels more comfortable seeing me face-to-face, which some people might, then we can do that.
And if they do it the telemedicine style or format, is it a full hour or 50 minutes or is it tailored? It could be 30 minutes or 20 minutes, like quick interventions or?
It's the same amount of time, but it anything can be tailored, even a face-to-face. So if a person only needed a certain amount of time, it could be tailored to meet whatever their needs were.
Now, the book is written and it's very readable, I should say. And it's you write it out as sort of a 4-week or you call it a 28-day journey to improving mental health. Mm-hmm. I'm curious is that just what you evolved through sort of years of practice, or is this specific to the high-level professional kind of giving that 4-week roadmap?
I gave 4 weeks because I know how busy we are, and I knew that each day needed to be very brief because I also realize how busy we are. So those are just 28 small bites of information, not meant to replace any kind of treatment whatsoever, but just to get people thinking. It's really targeted towards someone who doesn't have a whole lot of mental health background, who is just, you know, feeling through what's going on with them mentally. Everyone who reads that book may not walk away from it thinking, I need a psychiatrist. Some people might walk away thinking, you know what, I think I just need to take better care of myself. I think I need to, you know, go to lunch every now and then and not work at my desk every day. Or maybe I need to not check my emails every evening. You know, I think people will get different things from it.
Well, I was particularly interested. I mean, here's how the format lays out. Essentially, the first week, you're kind of learning about putting a name to whatever might be ailing you. And the second and the third week is tackling dysfunctional thoughts, and then dysfunctional thoughts continued. And it seems like in that second week, it's more of the people who have difficulty with self-esteem or lots of negative feelings about themselves, whereas in week three, it's sort of the opposite. It's people who have trouble kind of getting along or an overinflated opinion of themselves. And I mean, certainly there are elements of all of that in each of us, and I thought they were just really interesting. And so I guess, if someone is having problems, like here's an example on day 18, inflexibility to others' points of view, I mean, how able are people to take that feedback, you know, or they say, oh, this isn't me, or I'm always right, or I mean, I guess it's hard sometimes to do it from a book, but I mean, you got to start somewhere.
Got to start somewhere. Most people will look at that and go, man, that would be awful to be that person. And they have no idea that they are that person. Sometimes it does take someone you care about, someone close to you saying, hey, have you ever wondered why everywhere you work, you can't get along with anyone, to bring that, maybe it is me. Maybe I can do something different. But yeah, it's very difficult to see those things in yourself.
And then the final week, days 22 through 8, are the time for action. And so what I like about it is you really emphasize their self-care, and you call it here self-care for the busy professional, giving yourself permission to be broken. You're talking about daily gratitude. Those are really important. So you kind of make the full circle of identifying the problem, focusing on specific behaviors that may be detrimental or dysfunctional, and then kind of having a plan for action. I mean, you make it very logical and very, I think, pretty persuasive.
I hope people look at it and I hope they think, okay, this makes sense, or I don't have this problem, but man, I really need to work on this. Or even they may have a coworker that they're very close with that they think, man, she should read this. I think it is very easy to read, which is what I wanted. I didn't want a technical jargon-filled book that nobody but psychiatrists could understand. I wanted everyone to be able to read that and get something out of it.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Nicole Washington, who has just released her first book called From Introspection to Action. It's a high-level professional's 28-day journey to improving mental health. And probably the easiest place to read more about it is on her website, Dr. Nicole Psych. That's one word, drnicolepsych.com. And Dr. Nicole Washington, you're Currently, you're still have a day job. You are at Family and Children's Services, where you direct a couple of different units they have there. Tell us about, I guess, first the Urgent Recovery Center. What is that, and how does it work?
So the Urgent Recovery Center is a room with about 12 of those very large hospital-like recliners. And an individual can come into that room and stay for up to 24 hours. And it's more of a respite unit, or think of it like an urgent care for psychiatric issues. So you're not going there to stay. You're going there to get a minor need addressed, and then you're moving on. So we get referrals to that unit from local hospitals, emergency rooms mostly. We get referrals to that unit from outpatient doctors. People walk in. People can just walk in and say, I need respite. It may be someone who says, you know, I have an anger problem and there's a lot of stress at my house right now. And if I stay at home tonight, I'm afraid I may hurt somebody. So I need to come here and cool off. And they can do that. And if they need to talk to the case manager or visit with a doctor to have a medication adjustment, they can. And so we are able to see them and at least provide them a safe place to step away. Sometimes it may be someone who's intoxicated. And because they're intoxicated, they're not able to think clearly and they need to go somewhere to cool off for that period of time. Now, we do occasionally get people who walk in off the street who say, hey, I need a bed. I am not well. I'm in danger of hurting myself. I can't create a safety plan with you. I'm just not able to do that. And sometimes they are not always even able to make that decision, and we have to make that decision for them. But if someone needs a bed, then we end up finding them a bed, which can sometimes be difficult. But that's something that we do also.
And it's difficult to find a bed if it's necessary because of the shortage?
Because of the shortage, yes.
And that's something we'll talk about in a minute. I mean, in terms of addressing kind of statewide, that seems to be a chronic problem. Now, there's another, that's the Urgent Recovery Center, up to 23 hours in a chair, letting people, in a sense, take a timeout or almost a medical timeout. There's a different unit there called the Crisis Stabilization Unit that's a little different. So how does that one work?
So that is a 16-bed unit, and it looks very much like an inpatient unit. And if you walked onto the unit, you would have a very difficult time telling the difference between what is a true inpatient unit and what our unit is. But we have 16 beds, and we have 16 because that is the maximum number that Medicaid will pay for under this thing called an IMD exclusion. So we have 16 beds, and we cater mostly to Medicaid clients. We occasionally get people who don't have Medicaid and don't have an ability to pay us, but we're mostly a Medicaid unit. And people can stay there, you know, 5 days or so, get stable, get their meds adjusted, see the therapist, go to groups, just have a chance to step back, reset, and then leave, hopefully, with a pretty good discharge plan in place to where they can be successful.
And is the average length of stay there fairly short as well?
It's about 3 to 5 days.
Oh, so that's very short from where people who may have longer psychiatric hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. So you have 16 beds in crisis stabilization. You have 12 chairs in urgent recovery center. Mm-hmm. So it's not a huge number, set of numbers, but the Family and Children's is one of the largest, if not the largest, provider of mental health services in Oklahoma. Is that right? So,
yes.
So it sounds like the vast majority then of the work is outpatient, is people coming in and going home in a single appointment or single day or something.
Yes. Most of the people that we take care of are our own clients. They're already Family and Children's outpatient clients, or they're not engaged anywhere, and we will then move them into the outpatient system that we have in place. But we do take anyone to the facility. Like, anyone can come in to be evaluated for a chair. Anyone can come in to be evaluated.
What happens when you're full?
So full is kind of in air quotes, because is there really a full? So there is a number at which we reach a capacity that we can't accept any more people from the ERs, or the police can't bring us anyone, or the COPES team can't bring us anyone, but anyone can still walk in because we have no control over that. And we would never turn somebody away who's walking in to a full setting. So luckily, knock on all the wood I can find, we haven't had a point that we have reached a critical level of capacity. But it's not uncommon for us to have periods of time where we are at 16 in our beds and we have 12 in our chairs, and we just are having to figure out how to make it work.
How long have those units been open?
5 years in October.
And they opened the same time. Mm-hmm. And tell us the location of that Family and Children's, because there's numerous locations of Family and Children's.
Yes. It's at 11th and Houston, so across from the OSU hospital.
Okay. And do you get a lot of repeat business, people who you know fairly well who wind up coming back, you know, on a repeated basis, or not necessarily?
We do. There are some. We have those familiar faces that we see a lot. And 99.9% of those are people that are struggling with having their basic needs met. And so it's a hard balance between wanting to do what's right by the system and wanting to make sure that we're helping those people. Because if I'm homeless and it's 20 degrees outside, I need to find, I'm stressed. You know, I'm stressed. I don't have anywhere to live. That's going to increase my symptoms. That's going to increase everything for me. So I may show up a lot if I have a lot of chaos personally or socially and I'm struggling with getting my needs met. We see those people quite a bit.
So I guess what percentage, if you know it, is of your clientele are homeless? Is that a baseline issue for many of them?
Many, yes. Yes, we see a lot of homeless population.
And so as you point out, that's going to cause basic struggles, and including, I'm sure, an ability to just have and take a routine medication on a daily basis.
Right. It is difficult for a lot of our people to be able to maneuver the medical system. It's hard for me to maneuver the medical system when I'm dealing with my kids or my own health stuff. It's very difficult when you have to deal with, I have to get there every month, and I have to ride 2 or 3 buses to get there, and I have to make sure that I'm getting my refills in, and I have to remember to take it every day, which is difficult for a lot of us, whether we have a mental illness or not. And you put a lot of chaos in, and people may forget, are there substances involved?
Yeah, so is that a significant portion of the clientele? Yes. Also has a coexisting substance abuse problem?
Yes, we see quite a few people with substance use issues.
Are there larger clusters of whether it's alcohol or other street drugs, or
We see quite a bit of meth.
Quite a bit of meth.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I've seen more PCP in recent months to year, I would say.
Huh.
But we see quite a bit of meth, quite a bit of PCP, it seems like. And then we do get, you know, alcohol, we get some cocaine.
So we, you know, in the national media, we read a lot about the opioid epidemic and heroin, the shocking rise in heroin use and abuse. But you're not seeing that so much in Tulsa.
I am not in my population seeing a lot of it. And that may be just based off cost or based off access, because meth is very easy to get. It's pretty inexpensive. You can smoke it, shoot it, whatever it is that you want to do with it. But I don't see a lot of my population using heroin.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Nicole Washington, who is a psychiatrist here in Tulsa. She is the author of the new book, From Introspection to Action. It's her self-help book. It's a high-level professional's 28-day journey to improving mental health with some really concrete ideas on how you can, get help if you need it, but also think through and address some problems that you may be having. And it was specifically designed with the idea written for professionals who may, you know, see going to a counselor or mental health professional or a psychologist, psychiatrist see a big barrier there because of stigma. And you can learn more about Dr. Washington and her work and her book at her website, drnicolepsych.com. And Nicole, previously you spent a number of years working with a program called IMPACT. Tell us about what that stands for again, and then how that works.
PACT teams in general are programs of assertive community treatment. We have 3 in town, 1 at OU, which is the one that I used to work for, and it's called IMPACT, Integrated Multidisciplinary Program of Assertive Community Treatment. And then Family and Children's has 2 of them. They have a program called COPACT, which initially stood for those with co-occurring or substance use and mental illness disorders. And then they have a second PACT program. Those programs are designed for people whose mental illness do not allow them to be able to maneuver that traditional system of going to the doctor regularly, taking your medication. These are people who are suffering with schizophrenia or severe bipolar disorder, for the most part, and people who just really can't make the connection of, I have this illness and this is what I need to do to treat it. A lot of them have poor insight into whether they're even ill in the first place. So I think all of us would struggle if we did not think we had something and someone was trying to force us to take medication for something that we did not think we had. So these are patients who are in and out of the hospital, can't quite stay stable on their own outside of the hospital, and so you bring the hospital to them. So PACT is known as the hospital without walls. It provides everything the hospital provides except the structure. So you have a doctor and nurses and social workers and therapists and case managers, and you have a peer person on the staff. So that's a person who's been in treatment before who's now in recovery, and then you can that person relates to the clients on a whole different level than you're able to as the doctor or the nurse or anyone else on the team.
And my understanding is PACT teams are fairly expensive from a cost standpoint, because you mentioned all those personnel and then there's travel and whatnot, but that there's a tremendous cost savings born because of all of the hospitalizations and emergency treatments and EMSA runs that are prevented. But you have to take a sort of a big picture view of it in order to realize those savings, because to whom the fees of a hospitalization accrue, and then where those savings are felt, you know, in an integrated system, it would work almost seamlessly. But of course, in the real world, that doesn't really happen. So I don't know. Do you have any knowledge of the costs? Or I mean, we talked about it a little bit. I think that give and take in April.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking close to we're talking $1 million probably to do it well. I mean, you have staff, and you may have, I don't know, 12, 13 staff, and you have supplies, and you have to supply vehicles. And I mean, there's a lot that goes into a program like that. And I think the savings is huge when you think of not just hospitalization days that it saves, but also incarceration days. Like you said, ER visits, just being touched by law enforcement, because a lot of these people with more severe illness symptoms, the police know them. They're running into them on the intersections. People are calling the police. Hey, there's this guy, and he's acting a little odd. I'm not real sure. The police know who they are. So just encounters with law enforcement, just ER visits, all of those things together. But you're right, in a system where no one person is having to deal with either of those things, it can sometimes you can sometimes lose where the savings happens.
Now, you were kind enough to join us for the give and take last month out at OU Tulsa, where the topic was Tulsa's Mental Health Improvement Plan, which is this 10-year plan that has been put together, underwritten by the Zero Family Foundations and with help from the Urban Institute. And it was a pretty comprehensive look, and interviewed dozens and dozens of practitioners and people in the community. And one of the stark findings was that on average, people with serious mental illness live a life that's about 27 years less than someone without, that's peer matched without serious mental illness. And, there weren't a lot of solutions, but I think one of the recommendations from the plan is to create this, almost this strike force, this team of, it sounds like, four advocates who will work to kind of link community resources in a more integrated or cohesive fashion. You were interviewed for the Mental Health Improvement Plan. I mean, what are your thoughts on the plan? Do you agree with its findings, first of all?
I think for those of us who work in mental health on a regular basis and who work with this population, I don't know that any of us were terribly surprised by much of the information that we see in that report. I think it is great to have the numbers and it's great to have the data, but I think most of us go, that's about what I expected. So I don't think that many of us are shocked. The life expectancy is huge. People with mental illness, especially your more severe illnesses, if they don't have the ability to make sure they're taking care of their mental health, they likely are not taking care of their physical health either. A lot of them are living in poverty, and so food options and access is a problem. Most times, if you're relying on places that give you food, or you're relying on inexpensive food, or you're relying on your food stamps and you're just limited in budget, you end up purchasing things that stretch, which are typically not the things that are best for you. If you live in an area where you don't have access to a grocery store, and so if you're hungry and you want to eat, you have to go to a convenience store, that makes a difference. Some of these clients may not even know how to cook because they may have missed that because their symptoms may have started at that time where we're all learning how to be adults and learning how to be our own people and clean and cook for ourselves. They may have missed that altogether. So it just may not be a skill set that they have.
If you were the, say, the health czar for Oklahoma or for, you know, or Tulsa or, you know, Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, are there actionable plans as part of the mental health improvement plan or what, you know, what kinds of things? I mean, one of the things that I think the plan calls for is an increase in the number of beds. And you mentioned that earlier, that difficulty sometimes finding outplacements for people who are in the urgent recovery center if they need ongoing care after 23 hours. It can be very challenging to find them a place to go. You know, so that's that would be a start, I suppose. More beds?
More beds would be nice, but it would be even nicer if we could provide more services to those people who aren't quite at the bed point yet. I think when budgets get cut, we cut things. We don't cut the outpatient treatment. We don't cut the inpatient treatment, but we may cut the in-betweens. And so they're really, I think we should have more access to programs that can provide people more support before they get to the point where they need hospital.
So what's an example of that? Like what kind of in-between support?
So an agency like a Family and Children's Services gets money from the state, and when budgets get cut and that money gets cut, you may show up at that outpatient clinic and you may very well need a particular service, but if you're not quite at a sick enough, I guess, point, you may not be eligible to get those services. And then people get defeated and they don't jump in. Maybe home-based services to someone who is an outpatient client and maybe they're having a dip and a little bit of a struggle and they could use a temporary home-based service. We may not have the funding for that kind of program anymore based on what we have to work with. So I think if we could look at more prevention type things, that would be ideal. I think substance use, we have to deal with that. It's very difficult for people to gain any level of stability with the amount of drugs that we see floating through our community and especially this population. So substance use is a huge thing. And then I think, you know, starting early with education, we talk about stigma and being a problem and just education early just to help decrease stigma for me as it relates to someone I care about, but also as it relates to me so that I know, oh, at a very young age, I'm feeling this way. I should probably talk to somebody. We all know that, oh, if your chest hurts and if it's radiating and if it's going into your jaw, you should call somebody. If you all of a sudden can't use one, you should call somebody. But we don't have that same level, I think, of education campaigns out there about mental illness and just mental health and mental wellness in general.
Well, the name of the book is From Introspection to Action. It's a high-level professional's 28-day journey to improving mental health. And it is written by my guest today, Dr. Nicole Washington, and you can find out more about it at drnicolepsych.com. Dr. Nicole Washington, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Best of luck with the book.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.